Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, and now for something maybe completely unexpected, Tom Hanks wrote a book. The prolific actor credits writer and filmmaker Nora Ephron with encouraging his writing years ago on the set of Sleepless in Seattle. He later wrote a piece about a friend in the film business and ran it by Ephron, asking, "Is this a thing?"
She said, "Yes. Yes, this should go into the New York Times style section, not a Sunday style section, but a Thursday style section. I will make the calls in order to try to make that happen, but here's what you need to do. You need to tell the people what you're going to tell them, and then you need to tell them, and then you need to tell the people that you have told them what you wanted to tell them. And this doesn't do that yet." And then I went back and took that advice and did it a bunch. And then she says, "This is better, but voice, 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 voice." Which meant that the information is there, but there's no voice. There's no,
right.
there's no sense of the narrative in it.
More recently, Hanks wrote a couple of stories and sent them to his friend, actor-writer Steve Martin. He again asked, "Is this a thing?" Martin responded in the affirmative, and Hanks kept writing. The result is Tom Hanks' first book, Uncommon Type, Some Stories. The type in the title could refer to Hanks himself, but mostly it involves his obsession with vintage typewriters. Each story includes one. Seattle Arts and Lectures presented this conversation between Tom Hanks and Nancy Pearl on December 6th at McCall Hall. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature, which mainly involves Tom Hanks talking like a pirate. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Seattle Arts and Lectures' Ruth Dickey introduces the conversation.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ruth Dickey, and I have the tremendous pleasure of serving as the Executive Director of Seattle Arts and Lectures, and I am thrilled to welcome you. Oh, wow. Thanks, y'all. I'm thrilled to welcome you to our 30th anniversary season and to an evening with Tom Hanks. I know. We are so grateful to the many partners who have made this evening possible. Thanks to our presenting sponsor, the Seattle Times. Thanks to our organizational supporters, all of whom are listed in our program. And special thanks for significant support of our public programs to For Culture, the Amazon Literary Partnership, Arts Fund, the City of Seattle Office of Arts and Culture, Glassy Baby, Nordstrom, and the Washington State Arts Commission. Let's have a round of applause for sponsors. Thanks to tonight's bookseller, University Bookstore, and last but not nearly least, yeah, thanks to all of you for being here with us tonight. Mm-hmm. The format for this evening will be a conversation between Nancy Pearl and Tom Hanks. As I'm sure you know, Nancy is a hero to book lovers everywhere for her books Book Lust and Book Crush, to her work championing books and writers, to getting all of Seattle and then cities around the globe to read the same book. Nancy is also the only librarian with an action figure and the author of the new novel, George and Lizzie. After an initial conversation, Nancy will include as many questions from all of you as possible. So if you have a question for Mr. Hanks, please write it on a question card and pass it to an usher. If you are on social media this evening, our hashtag for tonight is SalHanks. And now, the moment we've been eagerly awaiting. Of course, we all know Tom Hanks from his long career as an actor, writer, producer, and director, which has spanned 2 Oscars, 4 Golden Globes, and 8 Emmys, and more beloved movies than I can name. But we're here tonight to celebrate Tom Hanks as an author and to celebrate his new collection of short stories, Uncommon Type. In this lovely book, the stories are as big-hearted as you might expect from Hanks movies, whether they capture a group of friends on a journey to the moon, new love, the betrayal of love, or the immortality of love. At turns funny, insightful, and poignant, these stories each feature a typewriter in some way, small or large. In the story, "These Are the Meditations of My Heart," an old man sells a typewriter to a young woman, but urges her to put it on the table in the middle of her life, saying, Would you own a stereo and never listen to records? Typewriters must be used, like a boat must sail, an airplane has to fly. What good is a piano if you never play? It gathers dust and there is no music in your life. Whether Tom Hanks wrote these stories literally on typewriters, what a gift to all of us that he has heeded this invocation to put typewriters to use, put writing in the center of his life, to shake off the dust and bring stories and music to his life and now ours. Please join me in welcoming the hugely talented, typewriter-loving, beautiful storyteller, Tom Hanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So I guess Ruth opened the door for this question that I was going to ask you. Did you write them on a typewriter?
I'm not insane.
Be honest.
No, I did not want to have to literally cut and literally paste any of the stories. I wrote a lot of notes, a lot of test titles and, you know, fragments on, because I have a typewriter set up everywhere. I have easy access to typewriters that are pre-margined and all that. But I was in Atlanta working, and I always try to find the typewriter store that is in some town, wherever it is, and I bought an electric Smith Corona Selectomatic typewriter.
I had that typewriter.
Oh, yeah. With a cartridge that came in and out. And so I wrote a very rough and very sloppy typo-filled 3 or 4 pages on the story called A Month on Green Street. And then I came to my senses and brought out the laptop, and that's where I did the real work. But I have a really cool typewriter font on my laptop. If that rates, I can't get any noise out of the damn thing. But at least it looks like a clunky old messy typewriter.
Did you find that your background in films and playing all those different characters was a help or a hindrance in creating the characters in the stories and Uncommon Type?
Well, you know, I've never had any other job outside being a bellboy at the Oakland Hilton with Brian Wheelie, who is in the house tonight. Other than that, I've only ever been either an actor or somebody who was studying acting or a stage manager or a stage carpenter. What I have been able to divine out of my responsibilities to my job is, you must, when I say you, I mean me, but...
one.
One must come to work with the entire life history of your character in your pocket. And if it's not something you can research and find, you do have to make it up. It is a construct, because it is a sin, I think, to be an actor. If you've done the work, if you showed up on time, which is not a requirement, but will be the single trait that will get you more jobs. How is this kid Hanks? Oh, he's pretty good. Well, he shows up on time. Hire him. Know your dialogue. Know the text. There's no substitution for that. And also have an idea of what you're going to do. If you do those three things, you can be flummoxed if you don't know why you're there or how your character ended up there. And I don't know when this kind of like responsibility stumbled upon me, but when it did, it is a form of all-encompassing creating a character that you don't have to tell anybody about it, mm-hmm. but you have to have it so that when you have to jump out a window or yell at a dog or make an axe out of an ice skate or something like that, you know where it's coming from. And also the work that we do for the characters, that's that, but with the work that we do at Playtone, which is a company that we have where we make a lot of stuff, we're talking about stories all day long and trying to map them out and discover what the best media is for them, what the best venue is for them, how long the story is, because we do a lot of nonfiction and you can't do cradle to grave sometimes. You just got to hone out a perfect week of somebody's life or an event. And together, that is, without sort of knowing it, I had been preparing for a brand of self-discipline, I think, that came along, that served well when I decided to sit down on a blank screen and actually have to start explaining things to everybody who read it.
And what was the impetus to sit down at that blank screen? I mean, did you say, I have
hubris,
an idea? Hubris.
Hubris, ego. empty mornings with nothing really to do.
Oh, to keep off the exercise machine.
Well,
the
procrastination, big yeah. one there, Nancy. Thank you. The desire really was the freedom of being able to determine what the story was and how far it went and the cadence of it. In making films, you are, first of all, you have to go through an awful lot of other people. Mm-hmm. I've written screenplays, but screenplays are a lot of times it's just like architecture. It's a blueprint for something that is going to be touched and altered and changed and actually improved by a myriad of people. As an actor, I go into work and I provide the director with as many different versions of the examination of the theme as possible, and then they decide, and score and editing and all that other stuff goes into shaping a performance that I provided the raw material for, but did not make the individual choices necessary. Writing a story that is going to be, how long? I don't know, 7 pages, 44 pages?
Right.
No idea. Means that I got to sit down and completely unencumbered by the economics of making a movie. It's very expensive to drain Lake Michigan and fill it with marshmallows in a motion picture. It costs you nothing to do it in a short story. And that economic freedom is huge. Like, well, for example, like the story about the guy, the past is important to us, a time travel movie to, a time travel story to the 1939 World's Fair would be a prohibitively expensive movie to make.
Right.
It's absolutely free on paper. So the liberating aspect of having no constraints on wherever the story wanted it was really actually, you know, quite delicious. The other part is you need not a distraction. You need some other outlet from the oppressive pressure of making a movie over the course of the 50 or 60 days. And I did a lot of the writing here as to have some other outlet from the specific ongoing marathon that is performing one role in a movie. Because you have to take it very slow and you have to be tense for every moment of it. You know that on Tuesday you're going to be shooting a scene that is going to ask relatively nothing of you, and the next morning you will be shooting literally the emotional core of the whole fucking thing. And if you don't hit it that day, you don't have the movie. And this is why actors are insane, because this is why you find them in their underwear on the freeway at 3:30 in the morning. They're like, I have to shoot a scene on Thursday. I can't do it. And then you show up and you do it. So the being able to go to a different place, a lot of it was not unlike reading something that stirs you, because it was this other kind of like big massive puzzle undertaking that was quite frankly a solace.
So one of my favorite stories in the book is about this group of friends who go to the moon with the help of a lot of duct tape.
Yes. Which is a true requirement of going to the moon.
Absolutely.
You've got to have a lot of duct tape in order to make it to the moon.
And two of them work for Home Depot,
yes.
So they get a discount.
Yes. Right. which is a version of, you know, bidding out the contract to the lowest bidder.
Right. And they have an advantage over the earlier astronauts because the earlier astronauts did not have Google to answer, to settle arguments while they were going.
They actually had to use pens and papers and slide rules and things like that. They had to know junk.
Yeah, right.
Well, you can just enter it into your average laptop and or your iPad and get all the answers you need.
Come up with the answer immediately.
Yeah. What is the delta vector one that needs in order for the force in order? And what is going to be the timing of the fuel burn at the translunar injection? You got to burn for 7.2 seconds. The other guys had to write it down and slide stuff around and no physics and stuff like that in their heads.
So I understand from a previous conversation that that was the first story that you wrote.
Yes. Just by groans, how many people have read the book or bought it or take a look? All right. God bless you. I had actually, it came about because I had done an awful lot of reading. I was actually on vacation. And I just, you know, the thing when you haven't read for a while and then you go off on vacation and you start reading and your actual speed of reading and comprehension is about what it was when you were in seventh grade. But then every day you start reading faster and faster and faster and faster till you feel like you're the incarnation of Evelyn Wood. You can just read so fast and understand everything. After a really long reading jag, I had read these big volumes of the best writing of the New Yorker, by the decades. And you're reading literally the greatest writers that ever were. And they were all stories or articles or essays that were about somewhere between, 10 and 30 pages long. And I had had this idea for a long time.
Oh, you had?
Well, yeah, because this was one of the kind of stories that we had talked about down at the office. And I have just great affection for the concept of space travel and going to the moon. And I've always wanted to try to go back there as an actor, in a movie. And it's hard to do. You'd think they'd be overjoyed to give me the opportunity. But, man, that Sandy Bullock in space just ruined it for everybody. Gravity just wipe the slate clean of what you can do as far as space goes, and so I ended up writing this kind of story, and out of that, and I wanted to be that kind of classic number of characters. If you take a look at the Marx Brothers, there were four of them. The Beatles, there were four of them. Ricky, Lucy, Fred, and Ethel, there were four of them.
Right.
Seinfeld, George, Kramer, Elaine, there were four of them. So there's this great kind of like. It's like that's Forrest, that thing Forrest constant, it's called the four constant, and so I put together these characters and wanted them to mix and match and be a bit of a representative. I don't think there's enough Asian characters in the world, so one guy's name is Steve Wong,
right,
as opposed to Hideki Takahashi, just a guy named Steve Wong, and M-dash, and the strongest, most forceful woman on the planet Earth, in the name of Anna, and then the idiot non-named narrator, which I'm going to guess I would play in the course of if it was turned into a movie. But so I ended up like pounding this kind of thing throughout, and it actually, I thought when I had a version of it, and I said, I think this might be a thing. I don't know what you do with such a thing. But I know that Steve Martin is—he's a friend. I know him pretty well, and I know that he's multidisciplined. He writes all sorts of things, and so I sent it to him because I'm a fan of his plays and also his novels or novellas. What would you call them?
I think novels.
Novels, okay.
Yeah.
Shop Girl.
Short novels. Shop Girl's wonderful.
Yeah. And I said, "Hey, Steve," I sent it to him. I said, hey, "Is this a thing?
A thing?
A thing? Is this a thing?" And he sent back an email that said, yeah, I think this is a thing. Why don't I send it to my agent, which was Esther Newberg, who's a legendary ICM literary agent. And I got an email back from her. I said, and I said, hey, Steve said I could send it, blah, 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 so I'm the guy that wrote it. Here's my email address. And she sent me back, and she said, the email was essentially, this might be a thing. I don't know what to do with it. Let me think about it. That was the email. And a couple of days later, she said, well, we can try to send it to here. We'll try this. I don't think these people would go for it. Maybe because it's you, somebody else will run it. That turned out not to be the case. And she said, well, you know, I'll just send it to the New Yorker. And I said, I will frame the rejection letter from the New Yorker, and I will put it up there. I said, see what I did once? And lo and behold, they decided to, I don't know why, but they decided to do it, to run it at some point. And I ended up exchanging letters and drafts with Deborah Treisman, because the New Yorker goes through it, like, substantially. Right. I mean, they literally were asking me about ablative heat shield materials, and they contacted Alan Bean himself. And here's the goofiest thing in the world. I knew that on the Gemini program, the ablative heat shield on this Gemini two-person space capsule let out these types of noxious fumes from the heat when it landed in the water. And so there was actually this kind of like, not a poison gas, but there was an unpleasant kind of thing that if you breathed it, it would make you sick. And I knew that. And so I said, that's the kind of heat shield. And I wrote in there that M-Dash or Steve Wong got a little woozy because they were bleeding the noxious fumes from the ablative heat shield. And Alan Bean said, we didn't have that on Apollo. And they couldn't have it on Apollo because Apollo came all the way from the moon. It was going like 19 times faster than they did. So what they had was an ablative heat shield that just kind of like burned off. And he said, but you know, if they want to get sick, you could say that they could say that his nitrogen valve, they opened the nitrogen valve too quickly. And I immediately said, I put that in. All righty, sir, here you go. Boom, ready for the New Yorker. There were a few other fact-checking things I had to do. Literally, the price of a roll of duct tape from Home Depot. they checked that. So we went through that, and it ended up getting published. And I was just delighted to see Alan Bean's. I know Alan Bean. I met him back in the days of From the Earth to the Moon and Apollo 13. And I just think I have never been able to figure out why the fourth man to walk on the moon wasn't a household name.
Yeah.
And Alan Bean is not. If Alan Bean walked out right now, you'd think he's the sound guy that's laying cable for you. You wouldn't think he was a guy that walked on the moon. So, and that came to pass, and then they asked me if I had any more.
And then what did you? What?
Oh, I said, how many? Well, first I said, is there any money to be made in this? I mean, do you guys actually want to put out like short stories? Who buys short stories? I mean, what year is it, for crying out loud? What are you going to do, put it in Collier's Magazine, you know, the Saturday Evening Post? And they said, no, actually, they sell. I said, well, all right, well, how many would you need? And Peter Gethers, who was my agent, said, 15. And I went, really? Said, well, I got, you know, I thought about it a little bit, and I think I had 7, 8, or 9, you know, and then some other ideas. And I said, how long do they need to be? It said, however long they are. I said, well, this seems like a, man, seems like no rules are involved here. So I was a year late. They wanted it in a year, but I had to explain to them I had two other full-time jobs that I was working on. I started with a title that would try to wrap a story around a title. Like, for example, These Are the Meditations of My Heart. Yeah. It's kind of the story of that mirrors my getting my first really good typewriter and a few others. I was sort of looking for some brand of, give me a groan for the people who actually do write and stuff like that. Writers in my, yeah. So you know how it is. Sometimes you just got to have some like trick in order to get you to sit down and write, you know?
Yeah.
You got to fake yourself out somehow. And so that's when I asked Peter, I said, what if I just tried to put a typewriter in every story? Because if I got nothing else to think about, if I'm dry, I was like, where could I put a typewriter in this story? And he said, "That's hey." He said, "Why not take a shot? Good idea." And we started having email arguments of where a typewriter should go into a story. I don't like where you put the typewriter in this story. Well, fuck you, because I'm the writer and I'm the. Pardon my F-bombs, Nancy. I know that's not allowed in your library. And I use the F-bomb in a non-pejorative way, if you can believe that. It was meant as a term of affection.
So if you have questions for Tom, write them down and pass them to the ushers, and we'll continue talking, and then we'll get in as many of your questions as we can.
You're all right, thank you. Can I just give a quick shout out to Jennifer and Sophie and Tess?
I was going to ask
their
you.
Their old man is working hard and representing our country and fighting the good fight in Washington, D.C. But I understand they're here tonight. So, hey, guys, I got a nice letter from your old man. The Kilmers, ladies and gentlemen. Derek Kilmer, Jennifer, Sophie, and Tess Kilmer.
Did you do you have other connections with
Seattle? Oh, I got the Brian Wheely connection down
right,
here.
Right.
There's a daughter Wheely, a mama Wheely, and yes, let's all say it together, Papa Wheely is right over there. Old joke, but the old jokes are the good jokes, as Danny Thomas always used to say.
Was there a particular story in here that you had more trouble with than others? Are there titles that you still would like to build short stories around?
Oh, I have a lot of goofy titles that I don't even know what they mean, but they conjure up something. There was one was Welcome to Mars. That's a story about father and son surfing at a place called Mars Beach. That has been in my head for a very long time. It came about because I'm a horrible surfer, but I do surf on occasions when there aren't too many thugs out in the water who are going to beat me up or scream at me because I get in the way. And I was carrying my surfboard on a day where the surf was so lousy nobody was really out there, and I passed a car that was, it was a ranchero that had a bunch of tools in the back, like a construction worker getting in a few waves before went off to work. And a guy was behind is this working? Have I moved this so it doesn't work? Yes, go Apollo 13, we have you. love these headsets. There was a guy who was obviously a surfer / construction worker. And there was also a very well-dressed lady, and she was sitting riding shotgun.
Oh.
And it was early morning, and I just thought, what's going on here? That doesn't look like a guy who specifically came out to get some waves. It just had this air of intrigue and romance and illicitness to it. And that hung in my head for a long time, which grew into one of the stories. Every one of them, you start off thinking you're going to be examining one aspect of the theme, and it takes you down to another place. There's a story that has a very simple title called The Special Weekend, which is about a 9-year-old boy having a special weekend with his mom. His family is divorced. And that, if there's anything in there that is sort of based on an autobiographical aspect, it's that. My parents pioneered the marriage dissolution laws for the state of California. It's like famous, there was one famous, Elizabeth Taylor and Zsa Zsa Gabor were divorced, and Mr. and Mrs. Amos Hanks. Those are the only people I knew who were divorced in the planet. And there was I had a lot of confusion. We all thought this was what life was like, but what started off from the perspective, I think, of a 9-year-old boy trying to make sense out of life really became about his union with his mother and some parts of what his mother must have been through. And I wasn't anticipating that when I started working on it. But there it went, so much so that I sent it to my siblings and said, look, this isn't us, but you guys might recognize some stuff. And I heard back from them, oh yeah.
And you gave the name Amos to one of the characters.
It's funny, there's a story in there, and there's a big part of it that no one has picked up on. It's Christmas 1953.
Yeah.
I've always been fascinated by history and World War II, and we've done an awful lot of works about World War II. One of the things that has always been a question in my head is how in the world did the guys who survived World War II, who saw their friends killed and also killed people themselves, how did they go back and set up the railroad train around the Christmas tree in 1956? How did they do that? How did they forget? How did they move on?
Right.
Look, I'm still traumatized by the time I drove across the country by myself on the, when I was 21. Oh, it was a fraught 4 days. I had to catch a nap in the parking lot of a Husky self-serve in Nevada. I still remember it as I can probably walk through. And these guys, of course, they went off and fought and killed. And so there's a story in there about Christmas Eve in 1953. And a fellow gets a phone call every night, every Christmas Eve at midnight from a guy that he was in the war. And what particularly happens to them is unique. But the man's, it's Amos Bowling, who is called Bud. Amos is a great name, and my dad hated his name. He hated being Amos because guess what everybody asked him as he was growing up?
Where's Andy?
Exactly.
Wow.
And so his sister one day said, well, we'll just call you Bud. And so for that, he was Bud. He was Bud Hanks. But what no one has picked up in the story, because of what Virgil, the main character, has gone through, no one has picked up that Amos Bud Bowling, the soldier, is a homosexual, is gay. There's a segment of it in which Virgil, buddy says he realized early on that women were neither the passion or... we're not the passion or desire of Bud Bowling, that he just figured out that, he was one of those, he's one of those fruits and nuts that, which is the way they're referred to. But it's funny, no one who's read it has said, so you put a gay veteran in the Battle of the Bulge. No one's picked up on it. Maybe because I'm such a shitty writer that I wasn't, maybe I should have made a bigger deal about it.
Maybe you should put it in caps.
Yes. That should have been it. Hey, bud, how are you? Oh, my God, I can smell your lavender aftershave coming through the phone. Could have done something like that.
So how did you decide on the arrangement of the book? Of the stories in the book? Because what I loved about reading this book, and Ruth described it as big-hearted, which I agree, in the way that I would also add to that is that there's such a generosity of spirit toward the characters that it's just such a pleasure to read these different stories and see your concern and your love really for the characters. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. Well,
but
all right.
I can't remember what my question
your
was.
Your question was the arrangement of it.
The arrangement.
I'll help you out here, Nance.
Okay, good.
You started off asking me about the arrangement of the stories. And here's where, and I had, I think, an advantage of not caring. I didn't care what the arrangement was.
Yeah.
Because as an actor, I stopped going to see dailies a long, long time ago. I don't, if they're showing what we shot, can I see the date? A lot of times they don't want you there anyway because it's a brutal process of watching the mistakes that occurred yesterday. Well, that's terrible. We can't use that. But I used to go and I used to think, I'm so wonderful. And that scene is so fantastic. And then you see it in the movie and say, what happened? It's horrible. I'm the least objective person when it comes down to. So rather than re-examine what we did, I leave that to somebody else. Let them figure it out, because I can't tell if it's any good or not. Actually, I usually think it's just horrible. And in regards to this, when we put them all together, I asked Peter Gathers, what do you think the order should be? And he said, well, I'll put together an order, and if you don't like it, you can change it. And he sent me an order. I said, fine by me. I didn't care. I needed somebody else's sense of what the pacing would be and how to parse it out. And I was very pleased. But I hand my stuff over to a director, and an editor alters it and changes it and moves things around. So I was perfectly happy having someone else make that decision.
Do you feel that in some way the stories aren't yours anymore, but they're now the reader's stories?
Well, that's the movies.
Yeah,
that's an extraordinary thing. Yeah, they are. I mean, after a while, if you have those, you know, those moments of, you know, it's 1:30 in the morning, you can't kind of sleep, and self-confidence is a little on the wane, and you just need a little boost, and so you pick up your book and you read a couple of kick-ass pages. I think I'll sleep better now. Close it up. But they all have taken this trip. It's not unlike, I will tell you, it's not unlike when one of the films comes up on the grid, you know, you're kind of going through it, or you're walking in the room and, you know, your kids are ragging on you because you made some movie in the 90s that they can't believe your hair looks as stupid as it does. And you look at it for a moment and it is a completely out-of-body experience. I don't see the union of the movie left anymore. I only see this collection of moments that I have vague memories of. I can remember what other people say. I know what the other character. I can't remember what I'm doing next, but I can tell you whether or not I had a cold that day, where we had dinner the next night, who I had to pick up at the airport, you know, the night before that we shot that, or details of the house we lived in on Fripp Island in South Carolina or something. That I can tell you. And in the same way, I have a disconnected out-of-body experience despite how pleased I am with those 5 kick-ass pages.
Oh, come on, 10.
I'll take, hey, you heard it. America's librarian says there's 10 kick-ass pages in that. I leave it to you to find them.
So one of my favorite characters in the book is a columnist for a small town newspaper. And his name, will you pronounce it?
Hank Fassay.
Fassay.
Yeah, not
okay.
Fassay.
I wasn't sure how to pronounce it.
It was based on Bill Fassay from the old Oakland Tribune. Remember Bill Fassay? The San Francisco Chronicle had the greatest three-dot journalist in the history, Herb Kane.
Uh-huh.
Herb Kane, you remember Herb Kane? I started reading Herb Kane in junior high because we would all put a dime in the paper box and take out 4 copies and then read it on the way to school or stop for donuts on the way to school because we always walked. And so I learned the beauty of this perfectly meted out column that was on the front page of the B section next to a big ad for the Macy's. So people timed the cooking of their eggs to reading Herb Kane. The Oakland Tribune had a knockoff version of Herb Kane called Bill Fassay, and he tried to did the same thing for the East Bay. And the exciting goings on in San Francisco didn't quite work for Fremont and Walnut Creek. But it was our hometown paper, so we read it. So based on that, I wanted to have an old cranky columnist for the Tri-City?
Yeah, the Tri-City.
Tri-City right. Daily News. Yeah. What are those Tri-Cities? We don't know,
right. But
we know there's a Tri-Cities out there, and he's fighting tooth and nail for his relevancy and in the place. And so he was a good guy in order to go back to every now and again. I must have written like 17 columns for Hank Fassay, but ended up editing them down and connecting some of them because I wanted to take up time in the reading experience about as long as you would soft boil an egg. So if you're making breakfast, put some egg in some boiling water, read one of the Hank Fassay columns, breakfast is ready. That's just another reason.
Well, is he kind of, he's just so wonderfully grumpy and really wanting to remake the world better.
And celebrate the hometown. Because
yes.
A lot of it is like, why do you got to go to New York?
Yeah, right.
What, you're not going
right.
to get it? You got to go to New York for a good bagel? Nonsense. Hinchy's Delicatessen has a fine bagel. It's just down on Emory and 4th. Go down there. You want to go see a great museum? Oh, you don't have to go to the Museum of Modern Art. You know, there's a tractor museum out in Burnville. You got it. It's as good a museum as you're going to find anywhere. He likes to celebrate the glories of whatever those three cities are that are conjoined.
Was there a little bit of you in him that kind of well, in any way? I don't know. I sort of kept.
No, actually, he was a bona fide creation of pure fiction. I wanted to create that cantankerous guy. Who's, you know, is not quite so, oh, these newfangled this, you know, the thing. He does type out, he writes a paragraph,
yeah, right,
about the future of the paper, and then without spell check, he types one out, and it's, of course, it all comes out as gobbledygook on his phone. So he's he's digging his heels in at the modern era, but he's not nearly, I'm not nearly as cranky as he did, and I appreciate the bagels in New York City a little bit more than he does.
Who do you read? Like, do you? I know you like Alice Munro. I mean, are there other short story writers that you? Really?
No, actually, no. There's not. I mean, I read the great short stories, the collections. You know, Nine Stories by J.D. Salinger, Welcome to the Monkey House by Kurt Vonnegut. And then some others. I went online and found the unpublished or out of print short stories of J.D. Salinger before he became J.D. Salinger. But I don't, and I usually pick up, you know, those volumes you can get, the best essays of the year,
yeah,
the best sports, yeah, writing of the year, the best short stories of the year. I read a lot of those, but mostly I read some version of nonfiction, if not bona fide nonfiction. I'm reading a book right now that is, I swear to God, it's one of the most hilarious books I've ever read. It's called Everyday Stalinism. And what it is actually kind of dense. It's essentially a collection of what it was like to live under the daily aspects of totalitarianism vis-a-vis communist Russia when Stalin was alive. And everything was affected. I remember reading, there was an issue of Time magazine about the Russians, this was in 1980, about these people are totally different from us. They look like us, except their clothes are ugly, their cars don't work, and their alphabet looks like something Bizarro Superman, you know, works on all these things. And so I read this thing. I read it cover to cover, and communist life in communist Russia ended up fascinating me. And one of the most amazing things about it was they had drinking fountains, in which there was a communal glass that sat there. And you took, lined up one by one, took the glass, put in your kopeck or what it is, a ruble, press a button, and you would get soda water, bubbly water. And then you would stand there while people were in line, and you would drink it. Tovarich. And then you would put the glass back in its communal stand, and the next pusher would come, take that same glass. First of all, would this happen in the United States of America? Absolutely not. Because, look, all the cooties that are in that glass,
yeah, right,
that alone. Wow. But then on top of it was, that glass would have been stolen the day they put the... There would have been bands of thieves that would go around to all these things and steal. You want to buy a set of contraband glasses? We stole them from the soda fountain. And I just thought, that is, what country, what people have been trained? And you know what was the worst faux pas you could commit? Is bringing your own cup. I've talked to people who grow up in this, and I've asked them, oh, yes, yes, they were everywhere. The water was very cheap, and it was very good, but you must not bring your own cup.
Wow.
Because that's not what the great Soviet man did. The Soviet man shared the cup with everybody. So this is the kind of stuff that's in Everyday Stalinism. Can't get enough of it.
How did you find that? I mean, how did you happen upon that?
Oh, I read something. I read some reference to totalitarianism. I read a lot about totalitarianism. And it's in one of the greatest books about, and because they're almost like impossible to read because they deal with stuff that, who gives a shit about. But when it says, this is how they actually lived back then, and this was an example of it. So I'm reading about how rare they got oranges and how they would, yeah, line up for oranges. And I can't get enough of it. It's fascinating.
Well, here's a question from the audience.
Bring it on.
You'll love this question. I am a typewriter collector, too.
How many do you have? Does it say? All right.
My favorite is the Corona No. 3 folding typewriter from 1914.
Oh, that's a bitch of a typewriter, but what? Yeah, I know that.
What is your favorite typewriter?
Well,
Tom
first of
Hanks?
All, if you have a Corona folding, you know, that was literally one of the reasons it came out, because it was made for World War I. So they were made for correspondence and whatnot to take a small typewriter, and the carriage folds out. It's literally, you fold it up, and then there's the keyboard, there's the carriage. It's a rickety little machine. You can hardly really type on it now. But it was, hey, man, it was a new iPad in 1914. It was a big deal. I have some of those. Those are objects of art. I go back and forth on this a lot, but if you want to get just one of the greatest typewriters, I would say it's the Chevy Impala of typewriters, a car that is a typewriter that will work forever and everybody will think it's beautiful and it'll last 1,000 years. Get any Smith Corona, that was before they merged with Smith. Get any Smith Corona silent, super silent Clipper or Sterling, and that is a typewriter that will go 1,000 years. I think my most favorite go-to typewriter is probably going to be a Hermes 3000, which is big enough to be a desktop, and also happens to be. Help me out here. Who wrote The Last Picture Show? And
Larry McMurtry.
Larry McMurtry wrote all of his novels and all of his screenplays on a Hermes 3000. So, the Hermes 3000. Let me just a little thing about collecting typewriters. It's not the first typewriter that you get, because by and large, everybody should have a typewriter. Everybody should use a typewriter, because if you want to send a letter to your love that he or she will keep forever, type it. Because no one throws away a typewritten letter, and it will last as long as words are chiseled into stone. Everyone should have a typewriter. Thank you for your mercy applause. I appreciate that. But no one needs a second typewriter. Unless you are insane. So it's the second typewriter you get that trips you up into a realm that starts driving the kids mad and wonder, Dad, are we supposed to bury you with these things? What are we going to do with
them? How did you answer that question?
The answer was no, I'll give them away before you have to do that. I will not burden you with my vices.
How did the typewriter collecting come about?
Mostly, I think it was a need for order in my life, and my penmanship is horrible. And I knew how to type, and there was something about the design and the functionality and the. This is weird, but when you type, you are not applying words onto paper. You are stamping them into the paper. You are dyeing the fibers, if you have a good paper with a good rag content. You are literally dyeing the fibers with the letter. So you are actually creating a three-dimensional artistic document that is equal to the layers of oil paint on a Van Gogh masterpiece. So even if you're just writing a note to a friend who had you over for dinner last night, and you're just writing, "Cubby, did I get too drunk or what?" Your wife makes one F at star exclamation port ing good pumpkin pie. I'll be back next year. Love ya. T. That is a three-dimensional, one-of-a-kind painting that cannot be duplicated by anybody on the planet Earth. And so, therefore, it's a work of art, worthy of being hung up in some of the lesser museums in the Seattle-Tacoma area.
In the Tri-Cities. Yeah.
A typewriter is not unlike a guitar, in which if it hangs on a wall, all it has is 6 strings and it's made out of wood. But if you take it down, put it in tune, and compose on it, you can change the world. Now, you can do that with a pen, and you can do that with a computer, I know, but they don't make as cool a noise.
Here's another question. I'm a fan of yours and of Nora Ephron. Please talk about Because of Nora in your book's dedication.
Sure. Okay, yeah.
Good
yeah.
question.
Nora, when we made a little movie called Sleepless in Seattle. Yes, thank you. Look, I want to confess to being quite the mercenary because I have not been back to Seattle since we reshot 2 days of that in whatever year Sleepless. I know, I'm sorry, you know, I wanted to come up and see the ball field and the whole bit, but I just, you know, hey, I'm busy. I got four kids. Shut up. Leave me alone. When we started working on it, I only knew Nora through the legend that was Nora. I never met her. And she had directed a movie with Julie Kavner about a lady becoming a stand-up comedian that I really greatly appreciated. One of the reasons was because it had an actually geographically correct moving montage in it. You know, they actually did it by the map. And so when I had read the screenplay that she and her sister Delia had written, and we started meeting, and I had a big head. I was, you know, I'd been on a run, you know, I was a hot shot, and I was meeting her. She wasn't meeting me. I was meeting her. You know, it was one of these kind of things. And we started talking. And I complained about aspects of the script, one of them being from the perspective of she and her sister were writing about a father and his son. And I said, you chicks don't know shit. Oh, my son, he doesn't want me to go away. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I don't want to disappoint him. I so want to. I said, men don't do that. You know what men say? Oh, you don't want me to go away this weekend with some lady? You don't want me to? Well, I'm going, you little brat. What do you think of that? You're going to stay with the babysitter, and I'm going. And you know why? You know why Dad's going away with a girl that he knows? Because your dad's going to get laid this weekend. That's what's going to happen. And both Nora and Delia said, well, put that in. Say that. And I said, well, wait a minute. I mean, and they ended up constructing a thing in which that idea is said, not quite that. You know, you'd have to call child services if you heard that right. kind of conversation going on between a man and a woman. But we sort of put that in, and then we did that in a number other places in the movie. And when it finally came out and we were talking about it, I said, oh, that stuff really worked. And Nora said the most amazing thing to me that no one had ever said before, not a collaborator like that. She said, well, you wrote that. I said, no. I complained during rehearsal. I didn't write it. No, you wrote that. You came up with it. You talked about it. It's in the movie. I said, well, you guys wrote it and put it in the scene. We typed it. That is, and she explained to me, that is what writing is, even though I wasn't sitting down and trying to do it. And from that, we ended up having a relationship in which she was, and she's done this with many people, not just myself. She has gone out of her way to find people who were writers and cold called them and said, I'm Nora Ephron. If you're in New York, I'd like to have lunch with you because you are a writer. And she did that with me. In all of the stuff that we were, all the stuff that we were working on or coming close to working on, we exchanged all of our material, and we approached it. She didn't treat me as an actor who was looking for a project. She treated me as a writer that was going to try to examine a theme. When I actually did I wanted to write something very specifically. I wanted to, my makeup man, Danny Strepek, who's a legend in the makeup community, when we finished Classic Motion Picture, and please hold your applause, The Da Vinci Code, please hold your applause. We made like 12 or 15 movies together. And he called me when he was, he said, kid, I'm 75 years old and I'm calling you, Dad, because I want you to be the first one to hear this from the horse's mouth. I'm done. And I'm not just done, I am done. I said, so you're hanging up. Yep, I'm never going to get up at 5:45 again in the morning. I said, okay, I get it. And I thought about it. I said, Danny, could I try to like put together a retrospective of both you and your life and the time that we spent together? So I wrote a thing about Danny And I sent it to Nora with the question of, is this a thing? You can always just say, it's better to say that than say, listen, I've really thought about it, and I put together this piece, and I'm trying to examine, blah, blah, blah. Read it and tell me what you, it's either, hey, is this a thing? Because that question will always prompt at least a read of a paragraph or two of what you've written. And if they like it, and it's a thing, they read the whole thing, and then they tell you. If you're actually saying, would you read this 44-page thing, and then they'll put it on the side, they'll never get around to reading it. But she said, yes, this should go into the New York Times style section, not a Sunday style section, but a Thursday style section. I will make the calls in order to try to make that happen, but here's what you need to do. You need to tell the people what you're going to tell them, and then you need to tell them, and then you need to tell the people that you have told them what you wanted to tell them. And this doesn't do that yet. And then I went back and took that advice and did it a bunch. And then she said, this is better, but voice, 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 voice. Which meant that the information is there, but there's no voice. There's no
right.
there's no sense of the narrative in it. And that lesson alone powered it all. I've never forgotten those key lessons. I do some version of it all, and I always think of what would Nora think of this. And every time I fly to New York City, I think, oh great, I'm going to get to talk to Nora, and we don't get to. We did her play on Broadway called Lucky Guy, and thank you very much. If you saw that was great. My question would be, what month did you see it? Because I had no idea what I was doing for 2 months of that run. But that was the last kind of like really great grasp I had to work with her as a person with the sense of writing as well as the desire to perform it. So it's because of Nora that I wrote this book.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Tom Hanks is an Oscar-winning actor and the author of the short story collection Uncommon Type, Some Stories. Seattle Arts and Lectures presented his conversation with Nancy Pearl on December 6th at McCaw Hall. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.